This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on April 11th, 2013. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Next item on the agenda is the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on the California Republican Party, V8CRP, Audit A09-15. And who is going to start us off on this? Mr.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much.
Good morning, Commissioners. Before you is the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on California Republican Party V8. We request the Commission approve the findings in the memorandum. In the first finding, misstatement of leaven activity, the committee complied with staff's recommendation and amended its reports to correct those misstatements. In the second finding, failure to disclose debt and obligations, the committee complied with staff's recommendation and amended its reports to disclose debt that was incurred and debt paid during the audit period on Schedule Ds. With regard to finding 3, extension of credit by a commercial vendor, the staff is of the opinion that the committee has not demonstrated that Strategic Fundraising Incorporated extended credit within its ordinary course of business and that commercially reasonable attempts were made to collect that debt. Thank you, and if you have any questions, we'll be pleased to speak on them.
Thank you. Are there any questions or is there any discussion of the recommendation? Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First question I have is we received some responses from both the California Republican Party and from SFI last night. The SFI response, represented by Dan Backer, included some example redacted contracts with other non-political entities that also included some of the same provisions that were at issue in the contract that they had with the California Republican Party. Is there anything in those documents, and again, I know this is on short notice, that alters or affects the recommendations that you have in your report?
Mr. Smith.
Commissioner, we haven't had a chance to adequately review those documents yet, so there could be, but just an initial review that I had, I didn't see anything that possibly could, but it is some documents that we had requested previously, so it is that possibility.
Okay. Does the fact that they produced, because from reading your from the past drafts and also the recommendation memo, one of the concerns that seemed to be expressed was that you didn't know if it was in the ordinary course of business because you hadn't seen what they were doing with other political entities. It would seem now that we have other documents indicating what sort of arrangements are in place for other clients of theirs that are non-political entities, that would have some bearing on the outcome here. So it sounds like you may need to take a little more time to take a look at that. Second thing, this is pretty similar to a situation we had when we considered the Right March audit. And to me, the only difference between, or the most material difference between the contracts at issue here in this audit and those that we considered in Right March is the exclusivity provision. And to my mind, the exclusivity provision actually makes this an easier case than Right March. That made it look even more commercially reasonable. From the audit division's perspective, are there differences that we should be considering? Because, you know, I lined up a certain way. I thought that the Right March contract were okay. That I believe that they were in the ordinary course of the vendor's business. I didn't think that they were no risk contracts. If I'm in that position with respect to Right March, is there anything different about these that would change my position with respect to the contracts that are at issue in the California Republican audit?
Mr. Bonneman.
Thank you. I don't think specifically with respect to the contracts, but I just wanted to say that with Right March, they provided much more documentation than the California Republicans did. And to a great degree, that documentation was externally generated, where for California Republicans, its assertions made by that committee's legal counsel, NSFI. In addition, the documentation we got from Right March was more detailed in terms of describing profits that they made. And we think in Right March, Right March had more of the safeguards addressed than did California.
What safeguards did they have that weren't here? Because here we had the exclusivity, we had the term limit, the ability to terminate the contract at any time. What were they missing in this one that that Right March included? Because they didn't have exclusivity in Right March, if I remember correctly.
Based on my review of the documents this morning, and I'm using the three items that were addressed in Right March, the safeguards, in terms of requiring like an advance deposit, neither one had that I saw. In Right March's case, though, they had a lockbox system to assure payment, and the vendor had ownership of the names. In California's case, California received the monies and controlled the payments, and they were not always used to pay the fundraising vendor. In terms of contract limits, Right March had it. In California's case, although the California Republicans assert that the contracts were limited to approximately 2 years, the contract itself states that it shall remain in effect for the two-year period addressed, which I believe ended December of 07, and they'll remain in effect thereafter until written notice is provided by either party. So in my view, I didn't think there was a limit on the contract. As far as allowing the vendors to terminate, Right March had it where they could terminate at any time. In fact, they monitored the fundraising program in real time. So if a program wasn't bringing in the receipts it needed, they could terminate that program specifically. And for California Republicans, it didn't allow contract termination until after that 12/31/07 date. There's another clause in that contract that addressed that permitted the vendor to cancel the break-even guarantee, but it required a few steps to be taken before they could break that guarantee.
And what steps were those?
I have to go to the contract. Give me a minute, please.
Okay, sure.
And I'll summarize kind of what, I'll just read what the contract says. The break-even guarantee is contingent upon CRP's ability to faithfully perform its due. Is that okay for me to read this?
Sure.
Before I start, okay. The break-even guarantee is contingent upon CRP's ability to faithfully perform all duties as defined above. In the event that CRP fails to perform these obligations, Strategic will provide written notification of this failure to the CRP. CRP will have 10 calendar days to perform its obligations to Strategic. In the event that CRP fails to do so, Strategic has the right to cancel the break-even guarantee and will be entitled to full payment for all prospecting calls made on behalf of the CRP during the term of this agreement.
That's okay, I don't have the language in front of me, but that seems like a fairly robust authority to terminate the contract. That doesn't sound all that different than Right March.
I read it not to break the contract, but just break the break-even guarantee, so I may be misinterpreting it. Again, I just...
But isn't the break-even guarantee the kind of a sticking point from audit's perspective that make this more of a... I mean, even if it's not the contract, isn't that... That's kind of the nub of the issue here, isn't it?
I can't address that at this time. I'd want to think about it more. Again, I just had this morning to look at some of this stuff and put the information together. I apologize.
Okay.
It's not your fault that you only had this morning to look at it.
Just looking, just big picture at this, do we have, everything that I've read indicates that. Well, let me ask: were there any goods or services that were provided by SFI that were not paid for by the California Republican Party? Normally, we consider an in-kind contribution goods or services provided for which there's no payment or for which there's only partial payment. Because the information that's provided by both the California Republican Party and SFI is that not only were goods and services paid in full ultimately, but that they made a $4 million profit on this arrangement. Is there anything that would indicate that's inaccurate, or is that true?
Ms. Wheeler?
With regard to whether they were paid in full, there was a waiver of interest, so they did not pay over $100,000 in interest, $138,000 to be exact. So, and even in one of their statements from counsel, he indicated that the payments were nearly paid in full.
Okay. So there was interest a little bit over $100,000. Seems like that needs to be balanced against the fact that they actually made $4 million of profit on this as well. I mean, there weren't goods and services that weren't paid for in the normal sense that we consider an in-kind contribution. Is that correct?
Well, as far as the $4 million that was received, we have not verified that. I know that during the audit period, there was over $2.5 million and invoices that were sent to the California Republican Party.
Mr. Bonowich, you look like you wanted to.
The only thing I can add with respect to the invoices considered in this, I mean, the amounts considered in this finding, the one point almost 2 million, just flipping through this spreadsheet quickly, it doesn't look like all the invoices were paid, but again, I'm just taking a quick look at it.
Okay. Just shifting to the commercially, whether or not the attempts to collect the debt were commercially reasonable. The subjects of the audit claimed that ultimately they worked out an arrangement, and I don't think there's any, as far as I know, there's nothing to indicate that the debt wasn't fully paid off. Maybe there's this issue about the interest, but this would be the first time. What struck me as a little bit unusual here is we've made determinations as a commission on numerous occasions in the past where debts that weren't collected were the attempts to collect that debt were still commercially reasonable. In this case, it seems like we've got the opposite of that. We have debts that were paid off, but the commission's being recommended that we say that notwithstanding the fact that the debts were paid off, the attempts to collect that debt were not commercially reasonable. That's... Like I said, I've never seen us in this situation. It would almost seem to me that by definition, if the debts were collected, it seems like within a fairly, reasonable time frame that those attempts were reasonable. This seems the exact opposite of the normal situation that we're in, that we normally face. So I don't know if someone could point to me a case where debts that were actually collected, we made a determination that the attempts to collect those debts were not reasonable. Maybe I'll throw that out there and just if there's any information you can provide for me on others, but I'm just not aware of that because it strikes me as odd to make that determination.
Mr. Bonowitz?
I can't answer that question, but flipping through the spreadsheet very quickly, it looks like the payments of the invoices were made months after the invoice. So a significant amount of time elapsed between receiving the invoice and payment. And the invoices were due to be paid 30 days after receipt, according to the contract.
So what would have been commercially reasonable here? They've made the claim that they have, as far as I know, the California Republican Party is their biggest client. They wanted to figure out a way that they could get, that the debt could be paid off, that they could continue to maintain the relationship what they have with their biggest client, and that it somehow could be a win-win for others. That would seem to be commercially reasonable from both sides. If the alternative is that, it would have been more commercially reasonable to terminate the relationship with their biggest client, enter into some sort of, litigation or otherwise adversarial proceedings that may in fact lead to the debt not being collected in full. If that's where we end up, that would seem to be counterintuitive. So what would we have determined was commercially reasonable in this case, where it does look like the debt was ultimately paid off? And from my perspective, I think that the determination by the vendor of trying to do it in such a way that they could actually maintain the ongoing relationship with their biggest client, that would seem to be almost the essence of commercial reasonability. I don't know if there's anything to any response to that.
I'm not privy to a lot of the information on their debt collection efforts. I am just aware of one meeting that was held to try to resolve the debt, and that's where the interest was removed, and that's the only one I'm aware of. But again, I'm not aware of all the specifics.
Okay. And the final question I have is on the ordinary course of business. When determining whether or not extending credit is in the ordinary course of business, do you look at the vendor specifically and find out whether it's in their particular ordinary course of their business, or do you look at that line of employment? I mean, because we've seen this in Right March, SFI has claimed that this was the standard practice in the industry as a whole. Do we look at what's in the ordinary course from an industry wide, or do we look at it only as a specific vendor by vendor determination? And
Mr. Smith?
I think we would take both in consideration. We were seeking that information from California Republican Party, and we just didn't get any documentation to support that. But we would until now.
Yeah.
We definitely were looking to take that information in consideration from the industry and from the specific vendor.
Okay. That's all I have right now.
Just a comment on something that you said, Commissioner Peterson. I know we haven't had this for very long, but based on the letter that we got last night from SFI, it says SFI realized over $4 million in revenue and made a profit. So it doesn't say they made $4 million in profits. They presumably some part of the $4 million was a profit, but I don't know how much it was. So whatever that's worth. Is there further discussion? Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you. There's somewhere else in the record, I think a prior submission by Strategic that they submitted on their own. I think they characterized the $4 million as profit. It's a rather thick file, but I had read the recent submission that they made through counsel as through the lens of what I had already read in the file, so whatever the file says, it'll speak for itself. First, a comment on, I guess more of a process comment. I appreciate Strategic submitting the materials they submitted. It's unfortunate they've had to retain counsel. Not unfortunate for the counsel, perhaps. But they're not the subject of the audit. I want to just put that on the record. They're not being audited. So when I hear that they failed to produce documents and that sort of thing, that's not really true, because they don't have to. I don't know that they have any sort of obligation to provide anything. I guess if there's a vendor that's not the subject of an audit and the auditors really want documents, I think there's a procedure that they could try to secure them formally. Not encouraging that, but I just want to make clear that they're not the subject of the audit. The audit of the committee is the California Republican Party, and they are in many ways at the mercy of the vendor and the vendor's procedures, which is not documents that would be in the possession of the California Republican Party necessarily. So I there's already been some suggestion, at least I took it as suggestion, that documents weren't provided or the like. I'm not sure how certain documents could have been provided. In fact, Strategic did explain in their prior submissions that their contract terms with their contracts with their clients are confidential. See that they now retain counsel. It appears counsel's worked through that with them with redactions and whatnot, and have given us some examples. And that's been very helpful, as has the submission in general is very, very helpful. Couple thoughts, though, and reacting to the questions my colleague had for the auditors. First, whether or not the payment was made in a commercially reasonable time, and this goes to the invoices weren't always paid on time. They may have been paid late for a few months. Well, we know that. If they've been paid on time, we really wouldn't be having this discussion as to whether or not they extended credit because, well, they would have paid the invoices. So that seems to be kind of a red herring. That doesn't change the fact that from my point of view, and having read the full record, they did pay. I think the interest issue is somewhat of a red herring because it's not as if they simply forgave interest and moved on. My understanding, it was part of a much larger global settlement of the 2007-2008 cycle. So it wasn't that interest was just forgiven. It was part of a much larger give and take to make sure they got paid. So I don't think that's a free-floating issue of debt forgiveness. I think it's something that is part of the larger ball of wax, so to speak. The other issue that came up was the caging of the checks. I actually read it the opposite way. I think this is an easier case than Right March because the California party is caging their own checks. That's a cost that they're not offloading to the vendor. They're doing it themselves. And I do want the record to show, though, that it wasn't simply a trust me system. Under the terms of the contract, Strategic did have the right to audit the caging, so they did know what money was coming in and going out. In some deals, the vendor cages the checks because they want to ensure they get paid. So they take their money first, and then they give the difference to the client. Here, the California party caged the checks. We can't have it both ways on these contracts. We've had situations, and we being the commission, not necessarily since I've been a member, but I think it has come up, where vendors will cage checks. And then the client, the party committee, ends up in a world of hurt because the best efforts ends up not being done properly. The data is not transferred to the treasurer in a timely manner. You get a lot of slop on the reports. And the client says, well, the vendor, you know, we didn't even know because the vendor's caging checks. And the commission's answer has always been, that's tough, but that's life in the big city. The committee is the one responsible for filing the report. So this committee actually ensured that by caging checks, they had the information in real time and didn't rely on a vendor to do that, which to me makes this an easier case. In my view, the commission's been going now for over 30 years. By now, we should probably be able to determine what's a ordinary course of business. And it to clarify the reg, it's not really you look at everything or the specific vendor. I think the reg talks about the vendor's ordinary course. This particular vendor has been in business for years and years and years and years. They have 700 employees. They made quite a bit of money. In this case, whether they had $4 million of revenue or $4 million of profit, that's certainly a lot of money, no matter how one slices it. It doesn't make any sense to say that this particular vendor was somehow extending credit for reasons other than to try to make money. I don't see anything in the record to indicate that. What I do see in the record, though, is a rather compelling narrative as to what happened. Everyone knows the 2006 election was not particularly good for Republicans, including the California Republican Party, notwithstanding their gubernatorial success. Their candidate promptly said that he's really effectively no longer a partisan Republican, and the California party was kind of cut loose. And when you have these telemarketing prospecting deals, you know, part of it is an assumption money's going to keep coming in at a certain pace. It's not surprising at all that money stopped coming in at the anticipated pace and they got behind on the bills. They managed to work it out. Fortunately, Strategic didn't feel the need to abruptly end the contract and sue and cause chaos. I think they did the right thing. But it doesn't really matter what I think. I'm federal government. This is a private contract, and as long as it doesn't rise to the level of something prohibited by the act, I don't see it as really my business to micromanage the contract. Now, having said that, I think this contract is fine. What we do have is a MER, Conservative Leadership PAC MER from years ago, that concerned mail, fronting of postage costs and the like. That's not the same as telemarketing. The cost of making phone calls and how phone calls are made and programs done over the phone is significantly different than those done by mail. And in that case, you had some vendors being paid by the main vendor, and there really was no chance of the vendor being paid. I mean, they got into the hole, so to speak, to the tune of millions and millions of dollars. And so we have a case where we know that's wrong, but what we don't really have is any other examples where the commission has said these contracts are wrong. We do have some examples of where the commission has said that they're right. The 9118 AO, for example, regarding the New York Democratic Committee, explain how to do these things, but there is this wide gap of how to do these contracts between those two, and certainly I think this case is not really all that distinguishable from Wright March. Certainly Wright March, that vendor produced many more contracts, so you did have that as an auditor to look at, and their contract did, I guess, have different and perhaps more safeguards, but that doesn't mean simply because this contract doesn't have all that there's therefore a problem. I think looking at this contract, there's plenty of safeguards. My colleague has already gone through them. I think that was really just I think there's even more than that, but there's no reason to belabor the point. I can't support finding three because I don't think there was an extension of credit by a commercial vendor. It looks to be wholly consistent with how these sorts of deals are done. The icing on the cake came in through counsel with example contracts. So therefore I can't support finding three. I have a brief point on finding two, but if we're on finding three, I don't want to jump around on findings. If other people want to discuss finding three, so I'll yield back and at the appropriate time let us be recognized to talk about finding two.
Seems perfectly reasonable. Do we have any further? Oh, Mr. Holloway. We do have further comment on finding three.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on finding three on extensions of credit because I think we'd start with the basic premise that a contribution could come in two ways with respect to this transaction. One is the initial extension of credit, and the other is with the collection of the debt. The initial extension of credit we find at 116.3B. for incorporated entities. And we've been discussing where the fact that they eventually got payment. Well, if you look at 116.3, it doesn't say anything. That is not a factor when you analyze the ordinary course of business as to whether or not you eventually got payment. It doesn't say. It lists the factors. There are three factors that are listed. But the fact that the vendor eventually got payment is not listed. It talks about if there was a prior agreement and whether or not they paid on time in the prior agreement, but it doesn't talk about the current agreement. Secondly, when you look at the ordinary, when you look at the collection of the debt, the fact that they got payment, that's not listed. That's at 116.4D, and that does not list anything about the fact that they got payment. So, for example, if a committee did not litigate the claim, it did not send out collection letters, it didn't do anything, but the committee won the lottery, and eventually they paid, but they didn't do any of that. I think that will still be a contribution because they basically floated the committee until they won the lottery. So, yes, there could be a situation where a committee does not do anything according to 116.4D, but 10 years later, 20 years later, 30 years later, they eventually got paid because the committee won the lottery. Well, they floated the committee for 20 years. So, yes, you can have a situation where, yes, they didn't do anything to collect the debt, but the committee got paid. And so for good reason, that factor is not listed in 116.3B, nor is it listed in 116.4D.
Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you for that. Just a couple points. Although I'm sure they wish they did, the California Republican Party did not win the lottery. There's no 20-year float here, but you do really hit the policy that drives this reg. The question is a committee using a vendor to essentially float money and sort of offshoring, right? And I the facts of this case, I don't see that here. But you raise a good point. There are limits. No one's suggesting that people can float things for 20 years and simply because you win the lottery and make good that's the determining factor. As for the reg, you're right. It doesn't specifically talk about payment, but what it does talk about with respect to ordinary course of business is rather nebulous things such as established procedures. and its past practice. Now, they do reference the fact they had a similar issue with a 501c3, and they resolved it the same way. So I read that as being that this situation is consistent with their established procedures. Does a vendor that's not the subject of an audit have to provide established procedures to a degree that sophisticated counsel would advise them they ought to have just in case the FEC asks? I don't think so. Some may disagree on that, but I don't think that's required. Two does talk about receiving prompt payment in full. That's sort of the point Mr. Bonowitz was making about the invoices weren't paid on time. But the backstory, the narrative of why they weren't paid on time to me in a prospecting deal makes perfect sense. So,
but I think that's talking about the prior.
Mr. Holloway.
If you're looking at one, are you looking at 116.3?
I'm looking at 116.3C2.
B. 116.3B.
Well, that's the incorporated vendor. Right, which is right. A corporation in its capacity as a commercial vendor may extend credit to a candidate, a political committee, or another person on behalf of a candidate or political committee, provided that the credit is extended to in the ordinary course of the corporation's business, which is defined in C. I was defining the term in B, and the terms are substantially similar to extensions of credit to non-political debtors that are of similar risk and size of obligation, which. That's not a real fine point. There's a lot of terms in there that need to be defined and applied to specific facts, right?
Right.
My point is I'm acknowledging your concern that we're certainly not saying you can just float money indefinitely, but I think on the facts of this case and reading the reg, I think this contract is still fine, but I appreciate counsel's bringing, I appreciate the point. Second point is the collection. I think the record is rather developed on they did try to collect. Now, do you have to hire counsel and threaten a lawsuit? And that I don't think that's, you're not suggesting that's the only course that satisfies the reg. They do talk about numbers of emails and discussions, and in fact, the California Republican Party went to Minnesota to negotiate a global deal with the vendor. My experience, and again, as Judge Collier, I think, pointed out in the Carey decision, we're supposed to be experts in how things work. In my experience, when the client goes to the vendor to settle the case, there's expense involved there. That shows I think that shows some seriousness to try to work this out. And they did work it out, and that's why the ultimate payment is relevant, because I see it as part of the culmination of the effort to get payment. The reg is silent as to the mechanics of how you are supposed to demand payment. The reg is silent as to the nuances of these contracts, which for me, I think is a correct approach, because it leaves people to decide their own business priorities and terms. And unless you do have a situation where you have what we're calling the float, it's not the sort of thing that I think we need to concern ourselves with. I don't see a float here, unlike in MER 5635. I mean, not supporting finding three, it does not at all change MER 5635. So with that, if counsel has any reaction to what I said, happy to hear it, because I want to make sure. No, that's enough. Okay. All right. Enough on that. Okay. Thank you.
Well, just speaking for myself on this finding, I disagreed with my colleagues in the Right March MER, and I suspect I'm going to not MER audit, sorry, and I suspect I'm going to disagree with them again today. You know, whether they, you know, whether it's a float when the bills are not paid on a timely basis. I mean, there's some float. Whether it's significant enough to rise to the level of finding is, I guess, what we're talking about here today. And some commissioners may say yes, and some commissioners may say no. Similarly, on the interest, whether it is rises to the level of a contribution when a vendor says, all right, you know, as a sweetener, we'll waive the interest which you otherwise owe on money that you otherwise owe us. I think that is an in-kind contribution under our regulations. I suspect we're not going to get agreement on that one either, but the fact that they were trying to work out a deal, I appreciate that, but I think there are parameters under our regulations. So just just to get my views out there, I would support the finding if a motion gets made, although I suspect the motion won't pass. Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of last questions. About the interest, in terms of the negotiated settlement, if I was reading it correctly, that wasn't just waived with no consequence. That was waived on the condition that the California Republican Party otherwise fulfill its obligation to pay off the debt. Is that my recalling that correctly? It wasn't just purely gratis, we're just knocking it off the top. It was a conditional term in an overall debt settlement.
Yes, sir.
And then secondly is the issue about that was mentioned in the report about when debt settlements need to come before the commission for commission approval. The California Republican Party had some strong words about that, thinking, I think they, just to quote what they said, CRP believes that the Audit Division and General Counsel in their documents set forth a little-known, unattainable, and likely widely ignored standard with respect to obtaining the Commission's approval for any debt settlement with any creditor. We do not believe the Audit Division and General Counsel can seriously assert that all committees are required to obtain Commission approval for the resolution of every disputed or unresolved debt with creditors. What? Just want to hear your response. When is the requirement for commission approval of a debt settlement triggered? And is it correct that every one of those debt settlements has to be approved by the commission? And if not, when do we cross the line into requiring commission approval?
Does counsel want to weigh in on that one? Mr. Holloway?
Well, with respect to the debt settlement, first of all, I think the committee has a problem because it's an ongoing committee. And under our regulations, only terminating committees can request approval of a debt settlement plan. But let's play with it, for example, and say that they are a terminating committee and they would be subject to debt settlement approval. Then I have not seen a situation where a committee has been allowed to settle what was owed for less than the amount and the commission didn't approve it. And the reason we need to do that is that we need to see whether or not that particular settlement, that transaction to settle, results in a contribution. I think that's the commission's job, and that's the way the debt settlement regulations are set up. And that's for every committee and every creditor. It doesn't make any exceptions.
If I can add, I have a few statistics. I just touched base with Rand, but debt settlement plans below a certain threshold are processed through RAD, and above a certain threshold they're referred to OGC. In 2013, we've had 14 debt settlement plans reviewed and approved by RAD. 2012, we had 31. 2011, there were 39. Debt settlement plans 2010, 30, and in 2009 there were 25. Those do not include the ones that were referred to OGC and then brought directly to the commission.
And those are all terminating committees?
Yes.
Okay. So in the past, again, this is something that I can't recall seeing. When audit goes in and audits an ongoing committee, do we look and see whether or not every settlement of every debt with every vendor has first of all gotten the imprimatur of the commission? And if they don't, then that's going to be something that could be, I don't know, referable or at least brought to the commission's attention. Is that part of the normal course of an audit?
Mr. Horowitz?
Thank you. Yeah, I believe it would be. When we go out and audit a committee and we're looking at disbursements, if we see something, a debt settled for less than full value, we'd at least question it. And we'd probably bring it to the attention of counsel and see what we should do with that. So the answer would be yes.
And so, and when that happens, is there a violation for doing it, or does the commission then, if they retroactively say, well, it looks, does the commission can they retroactively bless it? Again, this is not something that I've seen come up a whole lot, and so I'm trying to get a little bit more understanding about how we've handled these things in the past, because again, that's not something I've seen, and I'm assuming that a lot of these audited committees at one point or another have had some issues with vendors and getting behind in payments and figuring out some way to make each side happy with the arrangement.
Yeah, in my brief audit experience, I hadn't seen anything like that. So
okay, well, I'll just. I mean, no big surprise. I'm I'm uncomfortable with finding three as well. I think that I can support the other portions of the audit. I won't be able to support finding three, which I guess we'll kick into additional issues at the next step. But yeah, that, the way I look at this, I think I don't see enough to say that this was outside the ordinary course of either the vendor's business or outside the ordinary course of business in the industry as a whole. And also, and I appreciate counsel's, walking through about what's commercially reasonable or not. I think this is far, when the vendor delineated all the efforts that were made, I think there was almost a page full of bullet points indicating what they were doing to try to get the debt paid off. I think this is far afield from a situation where that's closer to the lottery example that you gave. I think that the efforts, as I view them here, were commercially reasonable, and the commercially reasonable attempts actually resulted in the debt being paid off. So I won't be able to support finding three either.
Thank you. Just a small comment on something that Commissioner Peterson said. I mean, it's on the interest forgiveness. I mean, it was part of the debt settlement package, but there really was no, if you want to look at this in contract terms, no consideration for the forgiveness of the interest because they owed the money anyway. So they owed a debt, and the debt had interest. They owed all of that money. The vendor said, well, all right, we'll forgive the interest if we can somehow get the rest of the money back. Well, they already owed that money. They're not the vendor's not getting anything out of that deal. In fact, they're giving something up. So they owed X plus $138,000 in interest, and they're saying, okay, now you only owe X. Now, I think it's pretty clear that different commissioners view that transaction differently, while they ultimately might say, well, that worked to our benefit because we ultimately got the money that we wanted to get, even though we had to forgive the interest, they still forgave the interest, which was also owed. Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we'll probably have a disagreement on this. I think the consideration was they extended continued the relationship between the vendor and the party. I think that was of substantial value as well in order to maintain that relationship so further revenues could be generated as a result of that. You brought up a point earlier about profit, the $4 million, and I may have been a little bit imprecise. The four, because I knew I'd seen $4 million, I went back through. It's refers to the $4 million in revenues that
yes.
were generated by the contract, and that it's a little less clear about what the extent of the profit is. But I don't think that necessarily. I think the fact that it was profitable, I think, is relevant here. But just wanted to clarify where the $4 million. Didn't get plucked out of the ether.
No, I'm starting to worry that it might have been. I read the $4 million too. I'm just going by what was in the letter that
right.
we got last night.
So.
Any further discussion? Commissioner Walther.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned that they did not provide any evidence of the value of the exclusivity agreement. But what kind of evidence would they be able to provide to give value? What were you looking for?
Ms. Wheeler?
Well, thank you. We would think that they would provide some type of worksheet. They had exclusive rights to prospect for California, and if they had not had exclusivity with another customer, for example, to be able to demonstrate that that exclusivity clause that they had with California versus another client that did not have that exclusivity showed value.
Did you ask him for that? I guess it seems to me that to try and value exclusivity agreement would be a pretty speculative thing. It'd be hard to find anything more than a hypothetical where it might have a value or might not. I do think it can be valuable.
Right.
But in this particular case, what particular value did you see?
That's the thing.
Did you see that it did not provide value to the vendor to be exclusive? And if not, why not?
They didn't provide any specific evidence to demonstrate the value of the exclusivity clause versus not being exclusive to another client. So all we had this
narrative. But in your own analysis of their situation, what did you think? I mean, forgetting about the, you know, the other vendors, because that's even more hypothetical. But in this case, mm-hmm. would it have made a difference in terms of, you know, basically assuring that they were going to get paid? I think that was a question that I had. Were they likely to go out somewhere and get someone else under the circumstances of this case, and get another vendor?
I guess that's speculative. I can't answer that. I don't know.
Mr. Smith?
I think, Commissioner, we were just looking for a response to be able to have something to evaluate whatever the value was for the committee or for the vendor. And so when we didn't get the documentation we were requesting, we just didn't have anything to support their assertions.
I mean, I don't want to belabor the point because I understand that, but I just was wondering, I was just curious because was there a rationale afforded that under the circumstances of this case we really felt we needed if we were ever going to get paid? Was that the kind of discussion that was advanced or what?
Can you repeat that one more time, Commissioner?
Well, for example, if the exclusivity agreement had value to the vendor, did they explain to you why, under the circumstances of this case, they needed that or it provided them with adequate greater assurance that they were going to get paid if they were exclusive? I mean, what was the likelihood after 20 years of, after their long relationship and being in the position that they were in, they were going to pick up another vendor to start raising money, which was, to a large degree here, motivated to get their money back?
I don't know if we could answer that, Commissioner.
Well, I didn't mean to overpress the issue. I was just curious about that. What is about the interest? That does bother me a little bit because I see that as even in negotiations, if you'll just pay us, we'll just cancel the interest. Well, I mean, I'm not too sure that's what I would consider might be a practical thing to do. But I'm just wondering what reason was given to you as to any consideration that might be directed or obtained by waiving interest. Do you get the point? In other words,
I think the committee was arguing, and SFI, I think they were offering that if we waive the interest, because the committee is so financially strapped, then we will be able to continue our obligations and then ultimately meet the terms of the contract for payment. I think that's what they were putting forth. I think our position was, just as you've just cited and Commissioner Weintraub just indicated, however, is that the waiver of the interest was an obligation anyway. It was a part of the contract agreement. So to waive it ultimately resulted in the committee not paying the full amount due.
That's one area for me that I'm going to have a problem with. I do think this is a close call because certainly people who are in business over a long period of time pretty much know what they can do and what they can't do and are trying to work it out so that everybody can come out of the thing, and I understand that. So I am having I do find this a little more close for me. I haven't read except a quick skim of the letter that came in. Procedurally, I think, I'd want to mention that I think in the future it would not be appropriate for us to be receiving in an audit extraneous information that doesn't come through the auditing entity. And so procedurally, I would just suggest that that's a policy that we follow rather than out of the blue, especially the night before getting, because I don't open up my computer in the middle of the night just to see if anything came in after dinner. So I think really it's very helpful to, it's helpful to get anything we can to help solve the issue, but it's uncomfortable when you walk in the morning and have this confronted by an entity that you're not directly relating with.
Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In response to the last point, that's similar to the point I was making, although the point I was making, keep in mind that we really don't have a procedure for if you're a third party to an audit, particularly one here where really what's at issue is their contract, which is probably very similar to all their other contracts, so they feel that they are, their business model may be in jeopardy depending how it goes today. So I don't fault them for doing what they can to send something in. I think that the if it was that important, the auditors could have perhaps used the regular procedures to try to secure it sooner. But maybe it's something we think about because it's this is not going to be the only time this has happened. I remember Rightmarch, the vendor there had their own lawyer and a whole pack of stuff, and that was submitted to the auditors, and we considered that just because Strategic didn't do the same thing. I don't think we should fall Strategic, but maybe there's some common ground as to just have a process so the next Strategic that comes along knows how they can submit their stuff. The exclusivity value, I think there's two answers to that. The first is the rather obvious intangibles one gets. When Subaru becomes the official car of the U.S. ski team, my colleague is a skier, so he probably remembers those TV ads, there's a certain intangible that makes people feel good about Subaru. In fact, that I remember those ads is really testament to that enough. So that's kind of an obvious thing.
Did you ever buy one yet?
No. I've been skiing a couple times, and I wanted to rent a Subaru when I went.
Guess the ad didn't work.
No, it worked. I had a Subaru Legacy for 15 years.
There you go. Oh,
okay. Because of their skiing commercial.
But did you ski?
I don't know if what you called what I did going down a mountain called skiing, but I did attempt to go down a snow-covered slope a time or two.
Okay.
So anyway, there's all that. But what the exclusivity really gives them is essentially a guarantee of getting paid. Because if there's not the exclusivity, I think two things could happen. First, the CRP could hire somebody else and sort of do kind of a Ponzi scheme where they sort of churn and burn their house file to raise money to pay Strategic. And they end up sort of having this, they're always paying somebody to pay the guy they owe money. So being exclusive knows that CRP is giving up the ability to do that. Okay, so from the vendor's point of view, in addition to being able to tell other clients we're the exclusive vendor of the California party, which is kind of a big deal because California is kind of a big party and there's a lot of donors there and that sort of thing, that the only telemarketing calls that are going to be placed are going to be placed by Strategic. So that's a degree of control and predictability that they otherwise wouldn't have. And if I were Strategic, that interest payment, that's pennies on the dot. That is changing the couch compared to what exclusivity would guarantee me on the back end. Bringing me to the next point, well, what did they really give up when they gave up the interest? Well, CRP could have fought them call for call. If you read the contract in the definition section under donor services, it talks about who... it's a donor services constitute calling individuals who have a previous history of contributing to your organization. Okay, so this actually isn't prospecting. It's more house file. But then the question is, what's a prospect and what's a house file? And then it defines that if they've contributed within the past 24 months, and then if whether they're newly acquired. This is a whole subculture of these contracts. And if a client wants to really make a vendor's life painful, they go through call by call, and they start saying, that actually, we don't have to pay for that call because that actually isn't within the scope of the contract. You hit a donor that we already had, or they already gave twice, so therefore that doesn't count. So you could actually really punish them as part of a negotiation tactic. But what they did here was they didn't do that. They cut to the chase. And cut a deal. And in fact, they did they did something else, which was they renewed the contract, which again, from the vendor's point of view, is akin to money in the bank, because the CRP probably could have dragged this out and played a lot more games than they did. And I don't think we should encourage game playing. I think we should encourage people to work out their differences and move forward. And the fact that the contract was renewed, I think, is another factor that makes this deal palatable. I don't know if that helps the close call shift one way or another, but there is the exclusivity does have value in this world. Other than this Subaru ski team, it's essentially a quasi guaranteed revenue stream, because you know they can't go out and burn through their house file and get people to give money, so then they take that money and pay the vendor and move on to somebody else. These deals are long-term deals. You rarely see, particularly with a party committee, a one-cycle thing. Exclusivity, renewing the contract, all that is wholly consistent with a business trying to make money and not doing an impermissible float. Now, you add the word impermissible because there is always a float. And I don't want to say that, you know, that just to make clear, I realize there's a float, but there's a point where the float becomes impermissible and not within their normal practices. And I think this is well within that, and at least based upon how I read the record, I think some of this is ships passing in the night. I think a lot of the submissions kind of say, this is how it's done, don't you know this? This is pretty obvious, and they sort of flesh it out. And then the recent submission by Strategic puts it in more terms that lawyers would understand, or auditors perhaps. Whereas the auditors are looking for documents and looking for more documents and looking for more documents, there aren't more documents. The contract is what it is, and it is, I think, it does everything it needs to do, and then some, in my view. But I appreciate the opportunity just to address my colleague's question about the exclusivity and what else it brings, because it's one of these things I saw, and I said, well, of course that's why they did exclusivity, because it's a revenue stream, and it's probably not in the briefs anywhere, because in their culture, it's obvious. So with that, I'll yield back.
I guess the only thing I would say about that is, you know, exclusivity may be of value if it generates a revenue stream, but that again assumes that the bill is going to get paid. So how long one waits until the bill gets paid and whether it makes sense to barred away other parts of it. That all goes to the ultimate question of what's impermissible in my colleague's term. Anything else on finding three? Mr. Vice Chairman, did you want to address a different finding?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just briefly on finding two, one of our favorite issues, reporting of debts and obligations. I just want to point out that if you read the audit report cold, some of the numbers jump out and may seem to be quite large, and it is a large number. But I just wanted to point out the California Party correctly notes that this finding is not a failure to report debts and obligations. It's more concerning the details of how to report debts and obligations. As I understand it, virtually all their debts and obligations were reported, other than maybe $12,000, so they say. It's just a question of which report the debts went on. And this is something that's come up before. I think it's a rather hyper-technical point. Because what happens is you may have a contract signed in April and services rendered on April 30th, and then the invoice comes in on May 10th. And they end up showing it, and they pay it on May 15th, and they show it on their May report. Then they go through an audit, and the auditor says, well, really it was incurred on April 30th, so that should have been on the previous report that governs that reports the activity in April. So my understanding is that's really the kind of thing we're talking about here. It's not a failure to disclose. It's really a question of which report it goes on. Years ago, it wasn't that big a deal because there were much more quarterly filers. Now virtually everyone's monthly, so these reports come much quicker than they used to, and it becomes that much more difficult to keep up with the Commission's debt reporting rules, which, of course, are kind of weird because everything else in the FEC world is cash-based accounting. the debt reporting is accrual, so it's when it's incurred, not when you actually pay the bill, which is counterintuitive because one would think with their contributions, you can't go to the bank and say, I have 10 pledges, so therefore I can now spend that money. No, it's cash basis. It's when you actually get the money. It's generally when you spend the money. But with the debt, it's this weird kind of thing. And there's policy reasons why it's weird. I mean, I'm not sure that those policy reasons justify what we're doing, but that's not really the decision here today. But I just wanted to note that for the record, that at some point, I hope the commission revisits its debt rules, because since the changes in McCain-Feingold on filing frequency, it's becoming an easy target for folks that really, I think, are trying to comply, and they just get it on the wrong report. We had a recent case, it's now public, where money went through a joint fundraiser, and they used the date of transfer from the joint fundraiser to the principal campaign committee, not the date the joint fundraiser actually received the money. They did amendments, and for the most part, that tends to cure the problem. Here, the committee has, as I understand it, amended it to the auditor's satisfaction, has incurred the expense to do that. They haven't fought it. They probably could have gone transaction by transaction and tried to say, well, this one really was correctly reported or whatnot, but they really took guidance from you and, as I understand it, incurred the cost of doing this. So we shouldn't further cause them really any more harm on this, in my view. But I just wanted to clarify that, because it would be easy to take this audit out of context and say, you know, California Party didn't disclose all these debts. They disclosed it. It's just, it's very detailed stuff. And we're seeing more and more audits with this issue. And at a certain point, it really becomes the commission's responsibility to try to take a hard look at this, because it can't be that at a certain point, when enough people make the same mistake, particularly sophisticated players, we have to start wondering, what is the rule really the appropriate rule? Or is there an easier way for folks to get the public the information that they need without all this time and effort spent in audits going through their debt? It's not really fun for you, for the auditors either, to go through the debt issue. I mean, maybe it is. My guess is it's not. Mr. Bonowitz is nodding. No, he would probably prefer not to have to go through report by report by report, invoice by invoice, contract by contract, and figure this out. So that maybe the auditors would have ideas on how to simplify this for your own sanity. But I just wanted to put that out there. I appreciate the chair recognizing me to do that. Thank you.
Sure. I thought Mr. Bonowitz lived for exactly that sort of analysis.
May I speak on for the
sure, Ms. Wheeler.
With regard to the debt finding, there were 28 vendors that should have been disclosed on the debt schedule. However, only half were not. Those that were disclosed, there were instances where some debt incurred was not, you know, it either was, they disclosed some of it, but not all of it. So there was a 28 vendors that should have been disclosed on Schedule D. About six were, and that's why we came up to that number where the amount was only counted once.
Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you. But my understanding, though, is I think still that doesn't really change anything that I said or how I read the record. I mean, if setting aside 11 CFR and how we do debt, if someone gets their bill on, you know, May 3rd and they pay it, and it's due on May 15th and they pay it by May 15th, and you ask them, do you have any debt? They'll say no, because they think, well, they're paying it on time, right? But in the FEC world, if the service was rendered in April, the prior month, that's incurred then, so they are in debt, even though normal people do their life in cash basis would not think they're in debt. So when you say 28 vendors and that, you know, some of it didn't show up as debt, probably because they paid the invoices. We're not saying they didn't pay their invoices. It's a question of timing of payment versus when it was incurred and this hyper-technical stuff that's in the regs. Is my understanding correct on that? Or is there situations where they just didn't pay their bill and they had debt even under how normal people would?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
All right. Thank you.
Any further discussion?
on any finding? We're going to take a 5-minute recess. Okay, we're back. So unless we have further discussion, I think we may be ready for some motions, if anybody cares to make one. Commissioner Walther.
Madam Chair, I'll move approval of the audit report, audit division recommendation memorandum on California Republican Party. And as I do so, I'd like to say a couple things. I consider this a close call. I think that it's very hard to, practicing law after 30 years, not to understand the position when you've got a case, you're not getting paid, do you stay with a client, do you hope to get paid and get to the end of the case? And it's often good business to stick with a client and hope that it all works out. But I think that's might be the ordinary course of bad business, but I don't think it's the ordinary course of business that complies with the regs. And looking at the regs, I just think it's there were other things that needed to be done. But I don't want to fault what was done in the circumstances of this case. It has been pointed out to me that, first of all, I want to say that the documents that were attached to the letter could be of interest, and I have reticence to rely on these documents that come in a long and I'm sure well done letter without having a real chance for audit to take a look at this and give a response. I think they're put way at a disadvantage to be under cross examination here and not have a shot at really contemplating what's before them and the good work that this looks like it's represented. So I'm not comfortable assuming that everything in there would have, automatically convinces me without having a deliberative effort on your part to give a response. I'm moving to approve this and with those comments.
Okay, Commissioner Walther has moved approval of Audit Division recommendations as set forth in the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on the California Republican Party in Agenda Document Number 13-12. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you. Two things. I don't think we can punish the California Republican Party by making a finding that may not be a proper finding once the contracts, other contracts by the vendor that are not contracts with the California Republican Party are reviewed. So if my colleague would like take time to review the contracts that were submitted to see if that gets it closer to the regs, I would certainly support not pulling the trigger on this right now, because given that it's already indicated it's a close call, I'm curious if you think if strategic contracts are consistent with how they did their deal with the CRP, whether that would influence in one way or another, or if they provided more contracts. I just, based upon your comments, it seems like there could be a way for us to agree on this particular matter, but I don't want to punish the CRP because their vendor didn't retain counsel, and didn't provide contracts that they're not obligated to provide to the auditors earlier. Is there hope if they have more contracts that establish that what they did for the CRP is consistent with it does come within in the regs to a degree that may cause you to not support finding three.
Well, I don't want to quantify my views on that. I think it's a disadvantage that people were put in here. But I think the disadvantage, to the extent one is, I know there were a number of requests over a very long period of time to try and get these documents, and I would be very surprised if the audit committee didn't talk to the vendor about that. But to get them at the last minute, I think, is something that puts everyone at a disadvantage. But I can't quantify it. I did say that, overall, it doesn't look to me like what was done was unreasonable from a vendor's point of view. But I do think that there was not compliance with the regs, and I'm not too sure that would overcome that.
I agree with my colleagues that we are in an awkward situation, but I mean, this audit has been going on for a very long time, and one of the representations that has been made repeatedly to us is that the vendor had a strong relationship. This was their biggest client. They had an incentive to keep working together. And normally, when we get this kind of information, it is because the audited committee, and the vice chairman is completely right, the vendor is not before us in any sense. Normally what happens is the audited committee works with its vendors, who, in order to preserve the relationship, work with the audited committee, and we get this kind of information through the audited committee themselves, and they are able to provide that kind of information to our auditors. I know I've seen that in other audits over the years. So I share my colleagues, all of my colleagues' frustration. I think that, you know, we get a letter from counsel for the vendor at 6 p.m. the night before a vote with respect to an audit that's been going on for an embarrassingly long amount of time, actually. And the draft final audit report was conveyed to the committee, which, again, you know, we keep getting told has a close relationship with this vendor. The committee had it, last September, sometime last fall. It's been months since the committee received the draft final audit report and had an opportunity to work with its vendor to try and put together a response. So I share my colleagues' frustration on all of this, but I do agree with Commissioner Walther that under our regulations, the analysis in the audit division recommendation is correct, and that is ultimately the decision for us to make here today. And I'm ready to vote for it. Further discussion, Mr. Chair.
Just one comment. I think in Right March, the vendor there and all the contracts that were provided by the vendor through their own counsel. It wasn't through the client. It was a separate submission. If I have the right audit, right, that was the one where you had like the 30 contracts and all that.
That's correct. I'm trying to look up real quick who
actually
sent it to us.
I think Wiley Ryan represented the vendor.
I believe it was the
Aaron Fox represented Right March.
That to me is not. I mean, you may be right. That I don't know that that's here and there. I presume that lawyers talk to each other.
I don't have in front of me exactly who submitted the documentation. I don't have that information, and I don't recall exactly who submitted it.
It was one of them because we've had a number of these in a row. It feels like with these kind of contracts, and but the point I'm making is it's really not. You can't really say it's the norm one way or another how we get this information, but it, my recollection is in Right March we didn't have any problem considering contracts that were submitted not by Right March but by the third-party vendor through their counsel. Where here it's more of a timing issue, and I can't fault Strategic for not wanting to spring for a lawyer until they absolutely had to, and it fortunately really still don't have to, but well, here we are.
Commissioner Walther.
Just to follow up on that, not that this changes the view of things, but I think, and I agree, I don't blame anybody for making this effort to educate us further, because it is helpful, and Mr. Becker does great work, and this is always likely to have a beneficial effect on how we see things, but or the thoroughness by which we see them, whether we agree with them or not. But there's two things. If we have we don't have any procedures, so we can't say there's any violation here. But if we, as a matter of practice, accept documents coming in on the fly, not with the advance approval of the audited committee, we always run the risk that there may not be total agreement between the audit committee and the information that's presented by some third party. And there ought to be some way to make sure that what we're seeing from the outside party has been able to be commented on, at least by the audited committee. But also, it's just the point that I made out here. I think we always should be reticent to automatically jump on complex documents that come to us without some time for our own committee to give us their best shot at how they view it.
Any further discussion on the motion? I will call the question. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
No.
Motion fails 2-3, with Commissioner Walther and me voting in favor, and the Vice Chairman, Commissioners Hunter and Peterson, voting against. Are there any further motions? Mr. Vice Chairman.
I suggest we go just down the line and try to break this up, because I think there is some agreement.
Okay.
So I move that we adopt finding one regarding misstatement of Levin financial activity.
Okay. Any discussion on the motion to approve finding one on misstatement of Levin activity? I will call the question. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Well, that motion carries 5-0. Any further motions? Couldn't really tell from your comments on the finding two whether you're going to, in the end, support it or not, Mr. Vice Chairman.
I'm going back and forth. I'm not sure it's necessary to really make a finding, given that they've incurred the expense of making the amendments and been, as I could tell, cooperative on the issue. I mean, it seems to me that given that we now have a system in place where it simply doesn't go away, it moves to other issues, the public will at least know what happens. But I'm not sure once people take corrective action and do the amendments at this stage that we really need a finding. Now, in the past, there were certainly findings. This is not what used to be, but we do have a procedure now where if there's an insufficient number of commissioners that think it's worth a finding, it still ends up in the report, so everyone still knows what happened. It's just a question of whether there's a formal finding or not, and I'm not really certain that we really need a finding because the public record has been corrected. Now, in this instance, I think I explained earlier, with the debts and obligations, it's not that they didn't report it. It's very technical as to which specific monthly report it went on, and you get into very nuanced stuff about when debt's incurred versus when the invoice is issued and when the invoice gets paid. So I'm not inclined to support finding two.
Well, I think the point that Ms. Wheeler was trying to make is that there were vendors that actually were not reported.
Yes.
It's not just that they showed up on one report and not another, but that there was actually information that was missing from the public record until the audit. And they have, you know, to their credit, amended the reports now, and we appreciate that. But, you know, historically, when people don't amend until after the audit, we still make an audit finding that they initially were out of compliance. Now, there may or may not be votes for that finding, but that's my read. Yes, Mr.
Okay, then maybe I'm confused. There were vendors not reported at all?
Yes, sir.
Well, that's not fair to report debt and obligate. I mean, they reported paying the vendor, right? So the vendor was reported. The payment was reported. The difference is your view is that there was some debt floating prior to when they paid.
Exactly.
Right. So the vendor was disclosed. The payment was disclosed. There's no secret. They didn't have secret, you know, a dozen secret vendors, right? I mean, everyone knows who the vendors were. We wouldn't have the list of 28 if we didn't know.
True, but not at the time when it was incurred, the debt.
But it's the same issue. If you had a vendor perform a service on April 30th, issues an invoice on May 1st and you pay the invoice on May 2nd, right?
Mm-hmm.
For your May report, the report that covers the activity in May, you're going to show that payment. You didn't show it on the report that covers the April activity because, well, you kind of missed the, you know, whether it was incurred or not on the 30th. But that's really what we're talking about. That's a simplistic hypothetical, but at the end of the day, that's really, now it may be, there may be a timing issue where it's more expanded, but that's, we're not talking about hiding the ball and hiding vendors. It's still this same issue as to the very nuanced debt issue.
But if I may, the issue of, there's a reason why we require debt reporting separate from, even if you're also reporting that you have paid something to a vendor, if you also owe that vendor money, you still have to report it because there's an obligation there. And Congress has made this determination that, you know, when you owe somebody money, that's something that's of interest, you know, who the candidate or the committee is obliged to. Is a fact that is required to be reported, not just that you have a relationship with that particular vendor, but that you actually owe them money. And I don't think, correct me if I'm wrong, Ms. Wheeler or any of you, I don't think we're talking about the bill came in one day and then the reporting period closed the next day, and then, you know, we're not talking about a two-day slip here, are we?
That's correct, Madam Chair. It was sometimes months before the bill was paid.
Yeah. So I do think, you know, I might be more sympathetic if we were talking about, you know, that hypothetical where, you know, the bill just snuck in right before the reporting deadline and they didn't have a chance to cut the check until 2 days later. But I don't think that's what we have in front of us. Mr. Vice Chairman.
First, I was responding to something you said about vendors not being reported. I want to clarify that we're talking about debt, not failure to disclose existence of vendors. When you invoke the act, I hear you, Congress has passed a law, et cetera, but the reality is not all debt, even when incurred, has to be reported, right? Under a certain dollar amount, for example, doesn't have to be reported. Recurring debt, if you do that part of the reg correct. So the commission has, there is no moral imperative here on reporting the debt in the abstract once one looks at the regs. The dollar threshold, for example, I mean, it hasn't been raised in years and years and years and years. It hasn't even been indexed for inflation. My point is that there is not an absolute all debt must be reported when incurred at all times. It depends. So I'm responding to sort of the, just make sure it's clear there's not some absolute norm here that's at issue.
No, I completely agree with that. The norm is what's set forth in the law and the regulations on when the debt has to be reported. And I think what our auditors have told us, and I think they're correct, is that they didn't comply with those laws and regulation. And now they have. Now they've fixed it. Now they've amended. That's all good. But I don't think that obviates the finding. But if there are not four votes for a finding on to support finding two, please correct me if I'm wrong on that. Well, we've already made a motion to approve all of the findings, so that would cover finding two as well as finding three. If there aren't four votes to approve finding two, then there, I don't know that we need to do anything else. I'll just look to my colleagues. Am I correct that there are not four votes for finding two?
I believe that's correct.
Okay. Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's really all we can do at this point, then. You have your... Uh-oh, Mr. Calvert's coming forward. Does that mean I'm missing something? Do we have to do something else?
First one is the whole thing.
I don't know.
Do we, Mr. Herman, do we need more?
There's nothing further the commission needs to do.
Okay. Well, I think the auditors understand their next task is to prepare the final, what are we up to, proposed final audit report at this point? I always get confused myself on our terminology, which will include finding one, and findings two and three will go to additional issues. Okay. Mr. Palmer, are there any management and administrative matters?
Madam Chair, there are none.
In that case, this meeting is adjourned.